content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the April 22nd and 29th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker, the Department of Medicine. How to die in good health. The average American celebrates just one healthy birthday after the age of 65. Peter Attia argues that it doesn't have to be this way, by Dhruv Kular. Some of my earliest memories are of summers with my grandparents in New Delhi. I spent long, scorching months drinking lassi, playing cricket, and helping my grandparents find ripe mangoes at roadside markets. Then I'd return to the U.S., my English rusty from disuse, and go months or years without seeing them. At some point, my India trips started to feel like snapshots of loss. My grandfathers died suddenly, probably of heart attacks. My BG, my father's mother, fell and broke her hip in her 70s, and she spent her last years moving back and forth between her bed and her couch. My nanny, my mother's mother, developed excruciating arthritis in both knees. In order for her to leave her fifth-floor walk-up, my uncle practically had to carry her down the stairs. I have always wondered whether their fading vitality, the way their worlds contracted and their possibilities vanished, was an inevitability of aging or something that could have been averted. Many of us have come to expect that our bodies and minds will deteriorate in our final years, that we may die feeble, either dependent or alone. Paradoxically, this outcome is a kind of success. For most of history's, humans didn't live long enough to confront the ailments of old age. In 1900, a baby born in the U.S. could expect to live just 47 years, and one in five died before the age of 10. But 20th century victories against infectious diseases in the form of sanitation, antibiotics, and vaccines dramatically extended lifespans, and today the average newborn lives to around 77. Lately, though, progress has slowed. In the past six decades, medicine has added about 7 years to the average lifespan, less by saving young lives than by extending old ones, and often in states of ill health. In many cases, we are prolonging the time it takes to die. A growing number of celebrity doctors, futurists, and so-called biohackers now argue that it doesn't have to be this way. There are, by some estimates, hundreds of specialized longevity clinics, including some that charge six-figure annual fees, which claim to offer more of the world's most valuable commodity, years of healthy life. Perhaps the most prominent longevity evangelist is Peter Attia, the author with Bill Gifford of the best-selling book Outlive, The Science and Art of Longevity. Through his telemedicine practice in Austin, Texas, for an undisclosed price, Attia offers health advice, diagnostic tests, exercise protocols, and supplements to a wealthy and exclusive clientele. He also interviews an eclectic mix of scientists, doctors, and entrepreneurs for a popular podcast, The Drive. Oprah has interviewed him. Hugh Jackman and Gwyneth Paltrow follow his regimens. Attia graduated from medical school and trained to be a surgeon, but grew disillusioned during residency and dropped out. He became a consultant for McKinsey instead, and then worked for an energy company. Finally, in his mid-30s, a fixation with his own health brought him back to medicine. As a new father, he learned that he was pre-diabetic, and he reflected on men in his family who died early of heart disease. In his book, he describes his former physique as sausage-like. On a beach one day, his wife told him, "Peter, I think you should work on being a little less, not thin." Soon he was down the rabbit hole of complete physical optimization. Attia, now 51, has become convinced that science, technology, and targeted work can solve a uniquely modern problem, the marginal decade at the end of our lives, when medicine keeps us alive, but our independence and capacities bleed away. It's a scandal, in his view, that our lifespan has grown so much more than our health span. Many of Atiyah's prescriptions are obvious. Work out, eat healthily, sleep well, nurture relationships. The Harvard Study of Adult Development has found in 8 decades that human connections may be the single most critical determinant of long-term happiness and health. But Atiyah often extrapolates from scientific data to offer jarringly intense and specific advice. Want to be able to lift a grandchild when you're 80? Goblet squat 55 pounds when you're 40. Hope to lift yourself off the floor unassisted in old age? Try toe yoga. Atiyah notes that each decade after 30, we lose a meaningful amount of muscle mass and cardiovascular fitness. If we wish to slow that decline and to complete a centenarian decathlon of important latent life activities, carry groceries, climb stairs, have sex, we need to become athletes of life. Many in the life extension movement are quacks or hacks who peddle pills, potions, and false promises. Longevity skeptics tend to see the loss of our capacities as something to accept, not avoid. Ezekiel Emanuel, an oncologist and a health policy professor at the University of Pennsylvania, derides Atiyah as an American immortal who overcomplicates straightforward advice. The idea that you're going to get another healthy decade of life just by doing the things he says is hocus pocus, Emanuel, who served as a special advisor to the Obama administration, told me. No one's got that evidence. Half an hour of daily exercise clearly improves and extends lives, but it's hard to prove that Atiyah's intensive regimens are much more beneficial. By incessantly preparing for the futures, the skeptics say we mistake a long life for a worthwhile one. On a recent afternoon, I chased my 3-year-old daughter around the playground for an hour. When we returned home, she spread a jigsaw puzzle out on the floor and looked up expectantly. I liked the idea of sitting still, but my knees hurt and my back was tense. I had to transfer the puzzle to a grown-up table and sit my daughter in a booster seat. She didn't seem to mind, but I remember that day as the first time that my physical limits noticeably constrained what we could do together. Longevity has become a concrete problem, just as it was for my grandparents. I wake up with aches in long-ignored joints and tendons. I calculate with dismay the age I'll be when my children graduate from college or start their own families. One day, we're going to die. What should that mean for how we live today? In 1980, James Freese, a Stanford rheumatologist, predicted in the New England Journal of Medicine that better medicines and behaviors would soon enable a compression of morbidity, which would delay disease and debility until the very end of our lives. In the late 90s, Freese supported his hypothesis by publishing a decades-long study. University of Pennsylvania graduates who, in their 40s, exercised more, weighed less, and didn't smoke much were half as likely as others to suffer a significant disability in their 70s. They seemed to postpone the onset of disability by more than 5 years. But the alumni of an elite college may not have been representative. Freese died of end-stage dementia in 2021 at the age of 83, and his broader prediction never seemed to come true. If anything, longer lives now appear to include more difficult years. The compression of morbidity may be as illusory as immortality, two demographers, Eileen Crimmins and Hiram Beltran Sanchez, wrote in 2010. According to the World Health Organization, the average American can expect just one healthy birthday after the age of 65. Health spans are greater in countries such as Switzerland, Japan, Panama, Turkey, and Sri Lanka. Earlier this year, I flew to Austin to hear Atiyah's thoughts about how to change that. When my Uber pulled into his driveway, he was finishing his morning workout, so an assistant led me inside. where I spent a few moments looking at Formula One paraphernalia. Floor-to-ceiling windows overlooked lush hills, and a herd of life-size elk and deer models stood in the sun. I would soon learn that they served as targets for archery practice. Atiyah has a shaved head, a sharp nose, and a stubbled chin, which make him look like a mix of Stanley Tucci and Jeff Bezos. When he appeared, he was wearing a fitted T-shirt that emphasized his biceps. He led me to his kitchen, where he offered me coffee and mixed a brightly colored concoction for himself. "I always try to get some protein in the morning," he said. He eats as many as 6 sticks of venison jerky a day. When I asked Atiyah about the longevity movement, he bristled. "The term just smells of snake oil," he said. "Most of what I see out there is what I think of as sci-fi longevity. We're going to live to be 200, and death is going to become irrelevant." He handed me my coffee. "The way I talk about it is in a very low-tech way. Atiyah has said that he wouldn't want to live forever, even if he could, and he seems wary of a stereotype of longevity doctors. At parties, he sometimes pretends he's a race car driver or a shepherd. I thought I was going to get skewered for writing outlive," he told me. "I thought doctors were going to say, this guy is a grifter. He doesn't know what he's talking about." Some do say that, but others have become his followers. Like a consultant, Atiyah often explains himself using frameworks. In the time of Hippocrates, he said, there was medicine 1.0, a pre-modern system of diagnosis and treatment based on observation, anecdote, and guesswork. In the 20th century, medicine 2.0 deployed the randomized controlled trial to produce scientific marvels such as dialysis, organ transplants, and antiviral drugs. But Atiyah also sees medicine 2.0, arguably the type of medicine that I practice, as passive. It often acts as after the onset of damage, debilitating arthritis, a broken hip, instead of aggressively and proactively warding off illness and injury. Atiyah preaches medicine 3.0. We sat down at a sort of command center in his home office. On a large monitor, Atiyah pulled up a patient's longevity risk assessment. His team's calculation of threats to life and limb ranked by relative importance both now and in the future. Although Atiyah describes his approach as low-tech, his patients receive dozens of tests, some of them outside the medical mainstream, full-body MRIs, body fat composition scans, DNA analyses. He often screens for Alzheimer's risk, something that many doctors advise against, in part because patients can't do much about a distressing result. While filming an episode of the longevity docuseries, Limitless, Chris Hemsworth, the host, learned from Atiyah that he has a gene associated with a roughly 800% increase in Alzheimer's risk. Afterward, Hemsworth took time off from acting. The assessment on Atiyah's monitor was for a middle-aged patient who had been given a diagnosis of attention deficit disorder and had also undergone several surgeries. Running down the left side of a chart was a list of conditions, starting with the ones that posed the greatest risk, emotional health problems and physical injury. The right side showed percentages, the guesstimated chance that each condition would become an issue in the future. Cancer and neurodegenerative disease were small risks now, but they ballooned into dominant hazards later in life. "It's more art than science," Atiyah told me. "There's no AI that's ever going to be able to spit out these numbers. It requires clinical judgment." The patient's results seem to trouble Atiyah. "They are on a path to have a very physically debilitated last decade of life," he said. His practice omitted the names of patients and asked me to change their pronouns to protect their privacy. Atiyah's staff focused on 3 near-term suggestions. See a recommended therapist, work with a recommended exercise team, get a colonoscopy. They may have been powerful in their simplicity, but they were standard enough that I wondered whether all that testing was really necessary. Many more patients will soon receive a version of Atiyah's advice. Not long ago, he debuted a program called Early, a kind of masterclass on longevity which costs $2,500 to access online. In a series of slick videos, Atiyah, in the hybrid persona of doctor, teacher, and coach, sits in a leather chair and talks about anticipating and averting diseases. Soft music plays. One video cuts to Atiyah's muscles tensing as he aims a manual crossbow and strikes a faraway target. "Hope is not a strategy," he says later, looking into the camera. "The marginal decade is the most important decade." When I asked Atiyah what he sees as a threat to his own longevity, he spoke of a lifelong battle to keep his emotions in check. He previously described himself as a workaholic with anger management issues. During a business trip in 2017, he received a call from his wife, who was in a state of terror. Their month-old son had stopped breathing and turned blue and didn't have a pulse. She had started CPR in his tiny body. By the time first responders arrived, he'd regained a heartbeat and his skin was transitioning to pink. "Okay, call me when you get to the hospital so I can talk to the doctors in the ICU," Atiyah remembers telling her in his book. Then he went to dinner. 10 days passed before he flew home. "I don't try to forgive myself for it," Atiyah told me recently. "There was a really, really broken person who did those things." He paused as though replaying the episode in his mind. "Don't ever forget that bastard is out there, and make sure you work really hard to keep him at bay." The quest for physical optimization can easily become a substitute for deeper fulfillment. A decade ago, Atiyah exercised 28 hours a week and observed a strict ketogenic diet. His biomarkers were out of this world, he said. But he refused cookies that his children baked for him and pasta during trips to Italy. "I was doing everything to live longer, despite being completely miserable emotionally," he writes in Outlive. In a recent interview with The Times, Atiyah said that before attending an event at his son's kindergarten, he thought for a moment of the downsides. It would eat into his time for squats and deadlifts. "That's costing me a little in terms of fitness," he said, "but that's the trade-off I wanted to make." Atiyah wouldn't tell me how many patients he sees or how much they pay. There has been speculation that his services cost around $150,000 a year. One of his clients, Carl Barney, is the 82-year-old founder of a nonprofit inspired by Ayn Rand. He told me that during the past 3 years, Atiyah has encouraged him to diversify his exercise routines and sleep more. At Atiyah's urging, he now scoops collagen protein powder into his morning tea, drinks bone broth before dinner, and tries to consume another 100-plus grams of protein during the day. I asked him whether Atiyah's advice was worth the high price. "I have wealth, so for me, it's a bargain," he said. Atiyah let me join a video call in which 5 telegenic members of his team discussed new patients. A primary care doctor told the group about a patient who managed career stress by engaging in extreme sports. "If they can't do those things, a lot of their coping mechanisms will crumble," she said. But it is difficult to quantify the risk that an injury might incapacitate someone. "We have questions like, do you wear a seatbelt?" the doctor said. "We don't have questions like, do you cliff jump into the ocean?" The patient's test had identified hearing and vision issues. A full body MRI showed ambiguous cysts in an internal organ. Genetic screening suggested early dementia risks, and the patient had recently asked the team, "Should I just quit my job right now and focus on living my life?" But a neurologist observed that the patient's relatives had developed dementia only later in life. "This is probably going to be the most hopeful piece of news we give them," Atiyah said. We can say clearly no. We have a lot of runway. I was envious that the doctors could pay so much attention to one patient. Atiyah had time to ask how well this person flossed, something I don't ask my wife, let alone the patients I see in 15-minute increments. But the primary care doctor made me ponder whether there was such a thing as too much attention. The patient struggled with anxiety, she said, and seemed to be looking for validation of their fitness routine. Instead, we show them all these medical problems, she joked, and then we're like, why are they so anxious? A few years ago, Atiyah started an intense fasting regimen. Some lab studies have suggested that fasting may reduce inflammation and clear the body of precancerous cells, but there is no agreed-upon dose for healthy fasting. Atiyah decided that for about 2 weeks each quarter he would drink only water. After losing 15 pounds of muscle, however, he abandoned the practice. He has always been extreme, Stephen Levitt, the University of Chicago economist and a co-author of Freakonomics, who is a patient and a friend of Atiyah's, told me. Peter has been wrong a lot, but he changes his view when he runs into evidence that contradicts his theory. Levitt trusts and admires Atiyah, but acknowledged that Atiyah's fans in the longevity movement could go too far. Followers often become more extreme than the leaders, he told me. Atiyah takes rapamycin, a drug that affects the immune system and is normally used by organ transplant patients. The drug, which occasionally gives him mouth sores, has seemed to lengthen the lives of laboratory animals. Animal experiments are unreliable indicators of how drugs work in humans, and rapamycin is not endorsed by the Food and Drug Administration or medical societies for prolonging life. This is not like a vitamin, Eric Topol, a cardiologist and the director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute, told me. It's a serious drug that can potentially lower your body's ability to fight off infections. When I asked Atiyah why he has promoted the drug in his book and on his podcast, he said, there's a big difference between saying everyone should take rapamycin and saying I take rapamycin. He also cited a study suggesting that rapamycin bolstered immunity in elderly people. It is clear that Atiyah has prompted people to take the drug. Topol said that some of his patients had read Outlive and then asked him for prescriptions. People see him as the expert, so they are going to try something if he says he's doing it, he told me. His followers aren't going to be able to detect which recommendations are firmly grounded in evidence. Meanwhile, training dozens of hours a week might take more time than it will ever tack on. Good health could even drag out some terminal illnesses. Peter's theory of medicine 3.0 is that you get this long life where you're healthy and then you fall off a cliff, Topol said. It would be great if it were true. There is no evidence for it. Emmanuel, the University of Pennsylvania professor, has said that he wants to live to 75. He is 66. Living a long time is not an end in itself, he told me over Zoom. If it becomes the focus of your life, that is one of the worst mistakes you can make. It's not that we should not exercise or eat well. But everyone goes through a decline, Emmanuel said. Spending your life worried about all these tiny things is a waste of time. During our video call, Emmanuel walked to his bookshelf, pulled out a copy of Outlive, and read a line from the epilogue. It was only after much reflection on this whole experience that I really began to understand how emotional health relates to longevity. He slapped his palm against his forehead in a mock epiphany. Oh, really? Longevity doesn't matter if your life sucks? I mean, come on, it's ridiculous. Leon Cass, who served as the chair of the Presidential Council on Bioethics under George W. Bush, has written that losing our capacities might be a kind of prerequisite to accepting our mortality. Maybe the slowing of body and mind is what makes death tolerable. tolerable. He quotes Michel de Montaigne, the 16th century essayist. "Inasmuch as I no longer cling so hard to the good things of life, when I begin to lose the use and pleasure of them, I come to view death with much less frightened eyes." Montaigne wrote, "When we are led by nature's hand down a gentle and virtually imperceptible slope, bit by bit, one step at a time, she rolls us into this wretched state and makes us familiar with it." Near Barzilai, the director of the Institute for Aging Research at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine is sometimes credited with discovering the first longevity gene, an unusual variation in DNA that is linked to exceptionally long life. When people ask him to define aging, however, he does not talk about that, and instead tells a two-sentence story. An elderly woman turns to her husband and says, "Honey, why don't we go upstairs and make love?" Her husband responds, "Sweetie, I cannot do both." For decades, Barzilai has followed hundreds of Ashkenazi Jews and examined genetic, behavioral, and environmental factors that have helped them age past 95 in exceptional health. Centenarians die of the same things as the rest of us, but later, he told me, "You might live to 100 if you could pick your genes. Picking the healthy lunch option isn't likely to be enough." Strikingly, around half the centenarians in Barzilai's study have been overweight. 30% of the women and 60% of the men have been heavy smokers. When he asked a 100-year-old whether anyone had warned her about the harms of tobacco, she responded, "Yes, all four of the doctors who told me to stop smoking. They died." Atiyah tends to argue that individual choices matter not because they are all powerful, but because they are the power that we have. He compares healthy aging to investing in retirement. Contribute what you can, whether it's a daily walk or an extra half hour of sleep, and the benefits may compound over time. If I'm being brutally honest, I think some people are looking for a reason not to do it because it's hard, he said. He acknowledged that health, like wealth, is unequally distributed. Indeed, one of the most powerful longevity medicines is money, which can buy people less stress, better education, safer neighborhoods, and higher quality medical care. For this reason, Emmanuel argues that doctors should focus less on getting rich people from 90 to 100 than on improving health in communities where people die young. When I asked Atiyah whether his practice might perpetuate this divide, he told me, "I've never concerned myself with that. I do not think it's unimportant, but it's absolutely not a problem I'm interested in addressing." He pointed out that his podcast is free and his books cost less than $20. Atiyah has a term for his unproven ideas: evidence-informed medicine, or interventions that rest more on theory than on randomized controlled trials in humans. In his view, medical recommendations are often too conservative. In some cases, rigorous studies would not only take too long, but also be unethical or impractical. Try randomly assigning babies to ketogenic diets at birth. According to Atiyah, medicine's admonition to do no harm is sanctimonious BS that steers doctors toward passivity and resignation. But this line of reasoning leaves enormous room for extrapolation and could be used to justify almost any practice. Talking to Atiyah, I frequently reminded myself that I cannot diet and exercise my way out of many diseases, and there's no regimen to eradicate uncertainty. Still, I felt the pull of becoming an athlete of life. Too often, conversations about life extension devolve into unhelpful abstractions and untestable speculation. One appeal of Atiyah's advice is that it's so tangible. Critics can paint his counsel as blindingly obvious or needlessly complex, but he has, at least, inspired large audiences to imagine what a better approach to aging could look like. There is actually no such thing as atheism, David Foster Wallace once said. The only choice we get is what to worship. In a society that chases money, power, fame, and beauty, there are worse gods than longevity. Atiyah is a history buff and an avid rucker, which means that he likes to lug a heavy rucksack on long walks. In June, to mark the 80th anniversary of D-Day, Atiyah plans to set out from Utah Beach in Normandy with four friends, carrying supplies plus a 25-pound weight, just because. They hope to trek 80 kilometers through the night and arrive at Omaha Beach less than 20 hours later. During my visit, Atiyah agreed to take me on a gentler ruck in the hills around his neighborhood. We had lunch delivered beforehand. He had a salad with chicken, nuts, and balsamic vinegar, while I had a saucy pasta. I caught him glancing at my bowl and imagined him judging my macronutrients. Then I changed into my workout gear and met him in his garage, where he outfitted me with an army green rucksack. I generally recommend that people new to rucking start light, he said, and slipped a 30-pound weight plate into my bag. He added a few to his own, and we set out into the afternoon sun. After climbing a hill, we entered a clearing. Around us, a circle of oak trees stretched majestically into the air. A mild breeze cooled the sweat on my brow, and a flock of birds darted across the open sky. I considered stopping to look around, but I could hear the weights in Atiyah's rucksack clanging like a metronome, so I sped up. I was feeling pretty good. I made a mental note to offer to take one of his plates. I changed my mind after the next hill when my neck stiffened and my shoulders started to hurt. Why not just go for a hike? I asked, panting. Oh, I wouldn't find that as fun, he said. Plus, it's not as good for your trunk. In the distance, a school bus drove by. I envisioned myself lifting my hypothetical granddaughter one day and then adjusted my rucksack and straightened my posture. As we walked on, I thought about a curious body of psychological research which suggests that as we age and lose our capacities, we tend to grow more content, not less. This finding clashes with popular conceptions of growing older, but seems to hold across continents, cultures, and eras. I can't do everything I used to, a family friend who is in his 80s and has been married for 6 years recently told me, but I wouldn't say I'm any less happy than I was before. Lost pleasures, he said, could sometimes be replaced. Rounds of golf gave way to brisk walks, and when walking became difficult, he spent more time talking to his children and grandchildren. As we grasp that our days are limited, we seem to abdicate our need for control. We may try to close the gap between what we want and what we have. Healthy aging seems to require a shift in mindset as much as a shift in muscle mass. My calves started to burn. I felt a knot in my back. White clouds veiled the sun, and a few ethereal rays came through. It looked so much like the entrance to TV heaven that I half expected a deep voice to boom from above. Sometimes I think about all the people who've ever lived and how lucky I am to be alive right now, Atiyah told me. Like, if I died tomorrow, it would be okay. We started down a final hill. His house came into view. But while I'm here, I want to know that I gave it my all, he went on. We have this one shot. Wouldn't it be a shame if we didn't make the most of it? And now, from the April 22nd and 29th edition of the New Yorker magazine, are flying cars finally here? They have long been a symbol of a future that never came. Now a variety of companies are building them, or something close. By Gideon Lewis Krause. A little more than a decade ago, Founders Fund, a venture capital firm run by the entrepreneur, investor, and political gadfly Peter Thiel, issued a proclamation called What Happened to the Future? As an investment thesis, it was underwhelming. It advanced biotechnology, energy, and the internet as smart bets. But it was received as something of a spiritual treatise. Thiel was best known for his early investment in Facebook, but he believed that the nation had become sluggish. We might have been attempting to terraform nearby planets or surmount death. Instead, we made apps. His statement belonged to the genre of the writer F.T. Marinetti's Futurist Manifesto of 1909, which proposed that Italy's moribund museum culture be raised in favor of a machine cult of speed and steel. We are going to be present at the birth of the centaur, and we shall soon see the first angels fly. We must break down the gates of life to test the bolts and the padlocks. Let us go. Here is the very first sunrise on earth. Thiel, no poet, was punchier. We wanted flying cars. Instead, we got 140 characters. Where's my flying car? Quickly caught on as a meme in Silicon Valley and beyond. For Thiel, one culprit was obvious, regulators. In a contentious debate, he told Eric Schmidt, then the executive chairman of Google, that Schmidt was doing a fantastic job as Google's minister of propaganda, but that the company had capitulated to an ethos of caution. We've basically outlawed everything having to do with the world of stuff, and the only thing you're allowed to do is in the world of bits, he said. The economist Tyler Cowen offered a more neutral assessment in his book, The Great Stagnation, writing that perhaps the low-hanging fruit has been mostly plucked. The complaint found surprising allies. The late anthropologist David Graeber, who at the time had no clue who Thiel was, wrote, "A secret question hovers over us, a sense of disappointment, a broken promise we were given as children about what our adult world was supposed to be like. The question? Where, in short, are the flying cars? Where are the force fields, tractor beams, teleportation pods, anti-gravity slits, tricorders, immortality drugs, colonies on Mars?" Graeber blamed bureaucratic risk aversion and corporations concerned only with short-term capitalist incentives. By 2020, when the investor Mark Andreessen grumbled in one of his routine tirades that we still didn't have flying cars, it almost felt dutiful. While one segment of Silicon Valley lamented the perpetual absence of flying cars, another, it turns out, was quietly building them, or at least something flying car adjacent. Just 3 months after the Founders Fund manifesto appeared, a Canadian inventor named Marcus Ling invited his neighbors and a couple of friends to his rural property north of Lake Ontario. Ling was in his early 50s with a bowl cut of coarse graying hair. He instructed his guests to park their conventional cars in a row and cower behind them. He strapped on a helmet and boarded a device that he'd built in his basement. It had a narrow single-seat chassis and two fixed wings, one in front and one in back, each with four small propellers. It was at once sleek and ungainly, as if a baby orca had been hitched to two snowplows. Observers described it, for lack of a better comparison, as looking like a UFO. Ling called it the Black Fly. Ling, who had been flying since he was a teenager, had long dreamed of the perfect aircraft, something that didn't require a pilot's license and could take off or land anywhere. He'd paid close attention to past designs, but suspected that their propulsion systems were too heavy, too complex, and too unresponsive. In the previous few years, however, he'd noticed that full-sized remote control airplanes had all of a sudden become very good. They had enough power to hover and could be controlled with precision. It was nevertheless an entirely different thing to put a person inside one. He told me recently, the original had no redundancy built into it at all, and any single point failure would result in total failure. It was fundamentally unsafe. At his demo, the Black Fly's propellers came online with a whine, then a purr, and it lifted into a hover about a meter off the ground. He pitched forward in the direction of his guests. He'd thought that he would pivot into a skidding stop in the manner of a skier. As he initiated a banking turn, though, the edge of one wing caught on the lawn. I thought, this is not going to end well, he said. But the craft held steady, dug a curving divot through the 30 feet of grass, and came to a rest. The trip lasted about 20 seconds. It was, as far as anyone knew, the first manned flight in an electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicle, or EVTOL, pronounced EVTOL. Today, there are more than 400 startups in what is called the advanced air mobility industry. The term covers everything from actual flying car-ish contraptions to more traditional-looking airplanes, but it generally refers to EVTOLs. For the most part, these crafts bear a greater resemblance to helicopter plane hybrids than to automobiles, and they can't be driven on the road. They might better be described as electric aerial vehicles with the ability to hover and the no-fuss point-to-point flexibility of a car. Some are single-seat playthings. Jetson One, a Swedish company, has developed a craft that looks like a little aerodynamic cage and handles like Luke Skywalker's X-Wing. Others fly themselves. Ehang, a Chinese company, has been testing an autonomous passenger drone with a quadcopter design. Its Chinese name translates to Ghost Intelligent Aerial Robot. The first widespread use will be for air taxis, initially with pilots, and then without. That will move passengers between neighborhood vertiports. Matthew Clark, a postdoctoral fellow in aeronautical engineering at MIT, said, in a best-case scenario, we're seeing certification in 2 years and flying 2 or 3 years after that. The 2028 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles may feature the ferrying of athletes through the air from the village to their stadiums. Regular civilians, or at least the courageous among them, could have access to such services by the end of the decade. One company promises a 7-minute trip from Manhattan to an airport with an aspiration to land inside security. Seat prices would eventually be competitive with ride shares. Proponents imagine a system of cheap, sustainable aerial transit, ribbons of humming vehicles interlaced overhead. Ling's company, now called Pivotal, occupies a few nondescript buildings on the marshy end of Palo Alto, wedged in behind Google and a NASA research center. The company recently began selling the Black Fly to hardy individuals. It has the footprint of a monster truck, but it weighs less than 350 pounds. This past January, Christina Minton, Pivotal COO, welcomed me to the company's training center, a miniature flight school for prospective customers. There was a foyer with a sweeping CGI panorama of the aircraft in flight over a rocky Pacific coastline, a cavernous showroom with a single demonstration vehicle, a classroom, and the all-important simulator chamber. Minton, who served as a test pilot in the early days, told me, back then it was terrifying. You did months of training for 30 seconds of flight, with 15 people there to support you. Now, we just want to get more people in the air. She added, everybody comes down from their first flight and has the same exact face. Just the pure joy of flight. Pivotal's aircraft is permitted under the Federal Aviation Administration's special carve-out for ultralights, a concession to the reality that the government cannot plausibly prevent you from fastening a lawnmower engine to a kite and barnstorming over your backyard. Ultralight pilots are not subject to any training requirements. The Pivotal team is aware, however, that just one crash might render the company's trajectory unrecoverable, and potential customers are expected to complete a 2-week program at its training center. Meals are catered. Before I arrived, the company's PR person called to ask if I exceeded the pilot's weight limit of 200 pounds. The team had recently developed an abbreviated curriculum that took less than a week, and they had invited me to try my luck. If at the end they deemed me sufficiently unlikely to die and take the company with me, they would greenlight me to fly. My odds of success, she noted, were likely to correlate with my aptitude for video games. My small children were resolutely enthusiastic about the endeavor, my wife somewhat less so. The training setup looked like a dentist chair with two joysticks and a virtual reality headset. A software engineer at the company reminded me that this equipment could afford to be a little janky. A sim can't fall out of the sky. The actual black fly has the glide ratio of a dishwasher. A catastrophic failure would entail a direct plunge to the ground. As I hesitated at the entrance to the training room, Minton tried to reassure me. "The simulator is good," she said. "The simulator has to be good because even your first flight is a solo." A few years ago, the technologist J. Storrs Hall published a manifesto called "Where is My Flying Car?", one of the few recent cultural artifacts that takes the question seriously rather than symbolically. Storrs Hall's story begins not with the fanciful flying cars of the future, but with those of historical record. In the 1920s, a Spanish aeronautical genius named Juan de la Cierva invented something called an autogyro, a kind of low-rent helicopter precursor. The vehicles fell to earth a lot, but their passengers frequently survived. Unfortunately, the engineer himself died as a passenger in an unrelated plane crash. In the 30s, Waldo Waterman sold a handful of aerobiles, cars with removable wings and a road-ready fuselage. Machines like these might have been unwieldy, but the concept seemed within reach, especially once so many veterans returned from the war with pilot training. The aviation company Cessna ran magazine advertisements for the family car of the air, a sensible little plane that you could park in your garage with copy like, "Remember, Mrs. America likes to go places and see things, and when she finds out she can cover 600 miles in a morning to shop or visit in any one of a dozen cities, she's going to fly." By the mid-50s, it was almost a given that some future sedans would come with wings. If we were going to live in mile-high space needles, how else would we move about? The title sequence of The Jetsons, which premiered in 1962, doesn't show the ground once. George takes his wife and children to their respective floating platforms in his domed airship, and then heads to his office at Spacely Space Rockets, Inc. Storrs Hall estimates that George has a 1,341-horsepower vehicle, which draws on the equivalent of 1,000 pounds of jet fuel. Some of this imagery was the standard-issue utopianism of the bright-eyed mid-century, but it really wasn't that far-fetched. After all, many of the era's predictions came to pass. Portable radios, televisions with screens, the size of a pocket handkerchief, air conditioning, plastics. The Jetsons more or less foretold the invention of the Roomba, and flying cars were already being built. The aero car had wings and a tail that could be stored in a trailer. The Convair car had an airplane attachment that could be rented at an airport. But the flying car was always something of an engineering chimera. Ideally, cars gripped the road's surface rather than depart from it. A spoiler is the opposite of a wing. Most pure flying car designs have been jury-rigged compromises between a lousy automobile and a stupid airplane. The Convair air car's test pilot ran out of gas in the air. He'd been looking at the automobile's fuel gauge rather than the airplane's and crashed. He survived, but the project did not. The military continued to experiment with things like the air jeep, a small craft that didn't require a runway. But for the most part, the dream of a flying car was dead by the late 70s. For Storrs Hall, this was not inevitable. He lays out several interlocking reasons for our supposed technological stagnation. But the gist is that, as a society, we've lost our taste for Promethean ambition. Flying cars fell victim to the wave of hostility and suspicion of technology that swept America. In 1973, the FAA banned the Concorde from flying over the United States, citing noise concerns. Storrs Hall argues that it was the ban itself that prevented the development of a quieter supersonic flight. He sees a similar mentality at work in the retreat from nuclear power, which seemed well into the 1970s like the obvious successor to fossil fuels, but after the core meltdown at Three Mile Island in 1979, despite the fact that there were no documented fatalities, it became almost impossible to build a new nuclear power plant in the United States. This now looks like a mistake. For theorists of stagnation, flying cars were another victim of our unwillingness to bear the costs of progress. It's often remarked upon in boosterish circles that American society allows about 40,000 road fatalities a year, but refuses to tolerate even one aviation death. Storrs Hall told me of the FAA, why can't they say, if you want to develop a flying machine, go out in the desert and do whatever you want? I remember when Amazon was trying to test drone delivery, they had to do experiments in Canada. In the 60s, a heliport was built atop New York City's Pan Am building. After a period of inactivity, it was put back into use in 1977 with as many as 64 scheduled departures each day to local airports. That May, there was a landing gear failure. Four people were killed by spinning rotary blades. A fifth was killed by a blade that careened to the street below. The heliport was permanently closed. This story, as an explanation for why we don't fly out of our driveways, is both true and incomplete. It's also the case that the contours of aviation have begun to change. By the 1980s, flying your own little plane had grown so expensive that the activity shifted from being useful to being a hobby. At the same time, commercial aviation became not only vastly cheaper, but also less and less likely to kill you. 50 years ago, planes went down all the time. The most recent fatal crash of a domestic commercial jetliner was in 2009. For aviators, this is nothing short of a miracle. We didn't panic or retreat from technology. We panicked and improved it. But for decades, we didn't have the advances required to make a personal flying machine that would be stable, easy to use, and cost-efficient. And the safety concerns are strongly felt. There's this different limbic system response to flight, Cyrus Segati, a pilot and a prominent investor in Advanced Air Mobility Company, said. Everything in our bodies tells us that it's not normal. So the strong reaction to plane crashes as a society is, hey, I told you we're not supposed to be in the air, and you went in the air and crashed. Then, about 15 years ago, a lot of people simultaneously noticed that several relevant technologies had caught up with us. In 2010, Larry Page, a founder of Google, had Sebastian Thrun, a German engineer, over for dinner. Thrun ran Google X, the company's skunk works, and he was one of the world's foremost developers of autonomous vehicles. Page produced a spreadsheet of calculations, which Thrun described as similar to what Elon used to argue the correctness of Tesla. Batteries have become better and lighter, and electropropulsion systems dramatically more powerful. New sensors had improved autonomous capabilities. Page's calculations showed that there were newly viable methods to get into the air and stay there. We thought it might even invalidate self-driving cars because, all things being equal, you'd rather fly than drive, Thrun said. They decided that this was too experimental a project for Google. Self-driving cars were one thing, but flying one? Larry said, okay, I'll do it myself. In the next few years, Page secretly funded multiple companies, including one called Z.Aero and another run by Thrun called Kitty Hawk, that functioned as a kind of distributed research and development shop. His initial idea was to build a self-driving flying machine that could take off from and land in a parking space. He had an array of corporate jets, but presumably the trip to the airport was still annoying. In the first 5 years, he put more than $100 million of his own money into one company alone. Page, who initially kept an apartment above one of the design hangars, was never referred to by name. He was called Gus for the guy upstairs. One team had trouble sourcing batteries, so Page had bought 10 motorcycles off a lot and stripped them for fuel cells. Some engineers couldn't secure access to a wind tunnel, so they put their prototype on an exposed train car to Southern California. It was a bit of a madcap scene. At one point, a team of engineers devoted themselves to their entry in Red Bull Flugtag, a contest in which participants take a running leap off a pier and glide as far as they can. The team set a record, which still stands, using the wing design from its vehicle. By 2014, the team's proof-of-concept craft had completed more than 200 successful test flights. Word began to get out, and plane spotters skulked around outside the hangars, trying to get a glimpse of Page's unearthly machine. Soon enough, these successes ushered in an entire industry. Airbus spent 4 years developing an eVTOL prototype. A German company raised an enormous amount of money for a craft that was later rumored not to work. Storrs Hall attributed the sudden flourishing of flying machines to the prevalence of drone technology in everyday life, and to a greater mood of optimism about technology. The whole zeitgeist has changed a bit, and people are beginning to say, why aren't we landing on the moon anymore? Page spread his bets around. 3 years after Ling's maiden voyage, Pivotal got funding from Page and moved to Silicon Valley. In 2022, a former drone executive named Ken Karklin came aboard as CEO. He told me that when he took the job, he got a call from Chris Anderson, a former editor of Wired and later the CTO of Kitty Hawk, to say, welcome to Larry Page's Air Force. Most responsible urban planners believe that public transit is a political problem, not a technological one. The tools to improve urban mobility, trains, trams, bicycles, sidewalks, have been around for a long time. The issue isn't that we were promised flying cars and got 140 characters. It's our attachment to a nostalgic kind of gizmo-first futurism, one that speaks to a profound failure of the national imagination. There's something a little dismal about the fact that the mid-century dream of the future might, if everything goes perfectly according to plan, come to fruition in the form of saving half an hour en route to JFK. Then again, that isn't too far from the initial vision. Almost everyone in the industry thinks that personal aerial vehicles will arrive eventually. Maybe in 20 years, maybe in 50. If they do it, it will be through a series of gradual changes. The kind of thing that can look to the untrained eye like stagnation. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.